This is the takeaway for Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Go get 'em. Is that the message from White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer?
The president wanted to take the shackles off individuals in these agencies and say, you have a mission. There are laws that need to be followed. You should do your mission and follow the law.
White House Press Secretary Spicer yesterday explaining new Trump immigration rules, taking the shackles off in this case, allows customs authorities to more easily put the shackles on undocumented immigrants who have a record of minor criminal offenses. As part of our 100 Days, 100 Questions campaign, Mate Rodriguez on Twitter tweeted this question to President Trump. Mr. President, what are you going to do with DAPA and DACA? DACA, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, Obama's so-called dreamers. Well, they are safe for now, according to federal authorities. But that's just one question. At a moment of countless questions in the minds of immigrants and their lawyers, can we get some answers right here in our studio? I think so. We brought together Camille Mackler, Director of Legal Initiatives for the New York Immigration Coalition, with two undocumented immigrants who have very different anxieties about the near future. Andrea Bonilla is a DACA recipient born in Ecuador, now a freshman at Lafayette College. We've spoken to her twice before on this program. And Jongmin Yu is a Korean-born immigrant who has lived undocumented in the U.S. since he was a small child. He was too old to qualify for DACA. We last spoke with him in October of 2015. Camille, what are people you're hearing from most worried about?
I think a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of questions as to, you know, are they going to be able to remain in the United States? How, as a family, what does the future hold for them? And also, just more generally, how are they viewed in society today when they go out on the street?
Andrea Bonilla, you're a DACA recipient, right? So you're one of the dreamers, right?
Yeah.
You are out of the woods, it would seem. Do you feel out of the woods here? Do you feel like you're not going to be the object of all of this attention?
I mean, I feel, I guess, a little bit calmer, but I still wouldn't say that I feel completely safe because my family isn't completely safe. So I can't be calm if, like, they're not all safe and okay.
Yeah. And where is your family?
They're all in New York City.
Well, they're in a sanctuary city. I mean, where you are at Lafayette College, I don't think has the same protections.
Yeah, I mean, I feel protected here just because the president has released, like, statements saying that they will protect DACA students as much as they can. So I feel pretty safe here. But I would be, like, more scared for my parents just because, like, ICE was there and stuff. And they're definitely scared.
And Jongmin, what did you think of Trump before the election? And how about now?
Well, I thought Trump was going to lose like everybody else here in New York. And after he did win, I just thought maybe we should just give this guy a chance. And I guess only a month after his presidency, I guess the chance is over. So we need to fight back and try to mobilize and try to hopefully get a good immigration bill through Congress.
How are these new immigration orders a threat to you, Jongmin?
Well, I aged out of DACA, unfortunately, so I don't have any status. And my parents don't have status at all as well. So these immigration orders, they come after me right now if they wish to. And
is that right?
I guess they could. They could do anything they want to. I guess this is the big bad government going against me.
All right, Jongmin and Andrea, let's just have you dial up 311, the information number here in New York, for getting public services on questions like immigration status and what's going on. We've got Camille right here. Andrea, you said you had questions about your family. Why don't you ask Camille a few questions that are concerning you, even though you're a freshman at Lafayette College and don't necessarily have to worry?
Well, one of my questions was, should students apply for study abroad through advanced parole, or is it too dangerous now?
I would say right now I would not be traveling on any kind of parole, including advanced parole. That's something that they specifically pointed to in the memos and the FAQs that were released yesterday, that advanced parole and other types of parole are being abused in the administration's mind, and that they plan on clamping down on it. So I would not be advising anybody to leave the United States who doesn't have actual status in the United States. And DACA, unfortunately, is not a legal status.
Now, when you talk about parole, I mean, Andrea is not on Criminal parole. Help us out here.
I'm sorry. I went immigration lawyer on you. Parole is a way for somebody to be admitted into the United States, even if they don't have a valid status, a valid visa, I'm sorry, to come in. It's a way for them to be admitted so that they can figure out their status once they're inside the United States. It's used a lot for asylees, but it's used a lot in advance. You can get that permission in advance if you've got something in the United States.
Understood. Yeah. So, Andrea, were you considering studying abroad? Were you looking at some possible programs there at Lafayette? And all of a sudden, if I'm listening to Camille, forget about it.
Yeah, of course, because I was able to travel to Ecuador during the summer through advanced parole. So I thought that I could definitely do study abroad and that it would be safe. But since Trump won, I was like, okay, it's not safe anymore.
All right, gentlemen, your questions. You've just dialed 311, and Camille's on the line here.
Camille, I was reading the papers that these undocumented immigrants who just get apprehended, they have no court hearings and trial hearings at all. And I was like, that's so interesting, because I know in the criminal case, you actually have a right to an attorney, but immigration law, you don't have a right to an attorney. Now, you don't even have a right to a trial. Is that right before a judge? You don't have anything and they could just be deported like that?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, if you've had a hearing and you already have a deportation order, you don't get a second hearing before a judge. And that's always been the case. But if you've never had a deportation order, what they're saying now is that they're going to be greatly expanding some sections of the law. And if you entered without inspection, meaning you entered without a visa or a valid document, and you cannot prove in the moment of your apprehension that you have been in the United States for more than 2 years, they will subject you to what's called expedited removal, which means that you will be deported without a hearing. Expedited removal we usually see at the border when somebody's trying to come in and gets turned away, and now they're saying they're going to really significantly increase that, and that's obviously something that we find very worrying.
Are you paying attention to expedited removal? Is that the thing that Jungmin, you're most fearful of at this point?
Personally, I'm not fearful of being removed. I guess that's just me. Anyway, the point is, I fear for my parents. I fear for people crossing the street. I feel people that are just driving without a license. And I just think that somehow the United States, you know, this great land that we call home, should protect these people, those who are powerless and unfortunate. I think that's what it should stand for, the moral fabric of a society. And I just feel for these people who have no power at all and may get abused and taken advantage of and just thrown out of the country without any due process. And I think that's just sad.
So when you're lying in bed at night trying to fall asleep, what are you most worried about? I mean, if the old taillight is out on the car kind of thing, you mentioned driving without a license. What are the scenarios that you most worry about for you and your parents?
Well, you know, my parents have a grocery store in Brooklyn, and I help them tremendously. But, you know, they get robbed or victimized a lot during at night. I just fear that if the cops came, if we call them, of course, if the cops came and, you know, there was some dispute, that they arrest all of us for whatever violence that happens at the store. And I think a lot of people don't understand how much violence there is on the street and at businesses at night. So I'm fearful that without due process, that they would just be shipped back to Korea. And I would fight that to every bone in my body.
How long have you been here, Jungmin?
Wow, that's going to be 36 years coming December. And so I've been here 35 plus years, and I have no pathway to citizenship. And it's kind of sad. My parents, too, have no pathway to citizenship. And I think that the American public has to understand that this immigration system is dysfunctional.
Well, that I think we understand. But let me put that to Camille. How do you, if you're suddenly in the middle of one of these expedited, you know, down on the floor, pal, let's see your ID, how do you convey to the immigration, to the authorities, that you've been here longer than 2 years and you actually do have some rights?
I mean, that's been the biggest thing we've been struggling with, right, is that if you've got an immigration agent with a gun putting you to the floor, you're unlikely to try to assert the minimal rights you have to remain silent, to not let them into your home, to ask for an attorney. You do have a right to an attorney, just not one paid for by the government. What we're recommending is that people keep proof that they've been here for 2 years. That could be a lease, that could be school records, that could be, you know, any number of documents in as much as possible on them, but at a very minimum, somewhere where other family members and other, you know, neighbors, anyone will know where to find them and get them to a lawyer right away. Because once that kicks in, once that expedited removal process kicks in, we're talking about a matter of, you know, days, if not hours.
Camille, how does the idea of I actually spoke with a circuit court judge here in New York on the street right after the election, and she said in New York we're protected because we're a sanctuary city and because politically New York is so different from the rest of the country. I, you know, scratched my head and said, last I looked, it was still part of the United States of America. What does sanctuary do to the people that you deal with? Is it a protection?
I mean, yeah, it is a protection. It's not infallible, right? I mean, a sanctuary city doesn't have a giant wall built around it that keeps ICE out, unfortunately. But it does provide some protections. And I think it also just sort of is indicative of a larger mindset of wanting to protect and, you know, provide for immigrant communities. So certainly the lack of cooperation between local law enforcement and ICE is massive. It's very impactful. ICE is not very happy with it. I mean, it's what cities should be doing right now.
At the point of encounter with authorities, Camille, what is the best thing, the strongest thing that people can say to possibly protect them, keep them from being detained overnight, you know, get them in touch with an attorney, et cetera?
I mean, I think there's no getting away from being detained at that point, honestly, but staying silent, actually, just not admitting anything, not signing anything, saying you want to speak to a lawyer. But I think not saying anything is more important than saying anything at all.
Based on what you've seen of this administration, I mean, Jiang Min has been here for 36 years. If you do not have any documentation, can you expect over the next 4 years to be found, that is their intent, to find everyone who's undocumented who's been here and to do something with them?
I think that's their intent. But to be honest, I think that they're going to start hitting some pretty practical walls. I mean, just yesterday they insisted on 15,000 new hires, yet General Kelly told Congress less than 2 weeks ago that he wasn't able to do that in 2 years. So I think there's going to be a lot of practical and legal roadblocks along the way. But I do think that that is their intent, and I don't think anyone is safe right now.
Camille Mackler is Director of Legal Initiatives for the New York Immigration Coalition. Jiang Min Yu is a Korean-born immigrant who's been in the U.S. since he was a young boy. He's aged out of DACA. And Andrea Bonilla is a former radio rookie and a DACA recipient who is a freshman at Lafayette College. Good luck to all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is it going to be a meet and greet in Mexico, pure damage control, or something else for the new Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and new head of the Department of Homeland Security, John Kelly, both in Mexico today for the start of a 2-day visit with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto? The last time President Trump and President Peña Nieto were scheduled to meet, the visit was called off, you'll remember. Can Tillerson and Kelly get anything done in this environment? Jorge Guajardo was Mexican ambassador to China in 2007 to 2013 and consul general to Mexico in Austin, Texas, from 2005 to 2007. The ambassador has his doubts.
We need reassurance from Secretary Tillerson that the United States understands the benefit of this partnership, the diplomatic benefits. And from Secretary Kelly, we need reassurance in terms of, for instance, these immigration issues that have risen up, the executive order that was just put into effect yesterday, that among other things, for instance, says that everybody crossing the border from land crossings would be returned to Mexico. Well, that's, of course, an issue that would be of concern to Mexico because the majority of people coming to the United States undocumented are not from Mexico. That becomes an issue for us to just be told by our northern neighbor unilaterally that everybody caught coming in undocumented to the United States would just be returned to Mexico regardless of their nationality. So these are the issues we need to hear from both Secretary Tillerson and Secretary Kelly of what the thinking is behind this, how they expect to engage, how are we going to be working on this together. So it's a very timely visit.
We haven't heard a peep out of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson since he took office, really. And Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly is dealing with, as you point out, an enormous number of changing orders and regulations. But I'm just wondering if the status quo is something that Mexicans would find a reassuring return to.
I would say yes. I think the status quo would be satisfactory to us, as mostly, John, to most of the world. I mean, the way President Trump came in tweeting and picking fights with all these countries, friendly countries, countries that didn't even know they were in the radar screen, all of a sudden are being targeted. So yes, I guess we mostly want to go not to the status quo, but just to a civilized, normal way of engagement. That's what we hope Secretary Tillerson and Secretary Kelly bring to Mexico.
And if the alternative is that they've been told or somehow have some feeling of authority that it's time to talk tough once again with Mexico, what do you think the impact of that would be?
Oh, well, that wouldn't be a pretty picture. I mean, if they're playing tough, bad cop to President Trump, well, then there's absolutely no good cop in the picture. And I don't think any sovereign country will tolerate this type of talk. I mean, for instance, this whole thing about Mexico paying for the wall, everybody understands that's a non-starter. I think everybody understands it in the United States. Everybody understands it in Mexico. President Trump keeps saying it. I guess he thinks it's something his base wants to hear. He can say it as much as he wants. He knows it's not going to happen. So if they come to Mexico and even suggest that idea, I think that's absolutely going to be a non-starter, and it would just wreak havoc to the bilateral relationship.
If you could take the Trump rhetoric and the tone and all of the atmospherics out of the equation for a moment, and I know that's very difficult to do, what is it at this moment in history that Mexico, a very important ally of the United States, needs in this relationship?
I think we need a stable relationship, probably modernize our trade relationship. You know, NAFTA was created 23 years ago, so there are many issues of modern day trade that are not included in NAFTA. So I think Mexico and the United States probably engage in more areas than any other country in the world, probably save Canada. Because remember, we share a border, so we engage on everything. We engage on disease control, on water issues. We engage on crime. We engage on the environment. So if you think of all the ways Mexico and the United States engage, it's just impressive. Transportation. So we just want to have a good dialogue, which pretty much we have with every single department in the United States, every single secretary in the United States, until President Trump came and started blustering about the way the United States was just going to mishandle every country in the world, and that just pretty much ruined things for the bilateral relationship or for a civilized engagement.
So you think this is an uncivilized engagement right now between this president and Mexico?
Yes, but mind you, I don't think it's only just between this president and Mexico. I think it's between this president and Sweden, between this president and Australia, between this president and all the countries he's chosen to pick fights with. And you got to remember, no country likes to be insulted, just like the United States doesn't like to be insulted. So when you have a president who thinks it's fun and it's okay to insult another country because it just plays well with his base and because he says it as it is, well, yes, it provides for an uncivilized engagement.
Finally, could you remind Americans this fact that never seems to break through the rhetoric, and that is that the numbers crossing the border, it's an outflow from the United States, not an inflow from Mexico. And that no matter how much that's repeated, Americans don't necessarily get that.
Well, you make a good point. And yes, no matter how much it is repeated, people in the United States still think that there's this wave of Mexicans coming into the United States, that you need a wall to protect them. And in fact, census figures, Pew studies have indicated that more Mexicans are leaving the United States than coming into the United States. Now, there's a simple reason for that. Mexico's economy is doing well. Mexico's economy is doing well, among other things, because it's trading well with the United States. We have these linked supply chains in which when the U.S. does well, Mexico does well. And therefore, people are finding better opportunities in Mexico. And the truth is, John, Mexicans want to be in Mexico. Mexicans don't want to be in the United States mistreated as second-class citizens when they can't go to the police, where they can't send their children to school without fear of being arrested. So Mexicans want to be in Mexico, and lately the situation in Mexico has been good for them, so they're returning in big numbers to Mexico. The problem is, with President Trump, who keeps attacking Mexico, keeps attacking its economy, it makes it more difficult for the Mexican economy to keep up and for Mexicans to keep returning to Mexico. So I wouldn't be surprised with the way it's going, the way he wants to tear up NAFTA, if it ends up affecting the Mexican economy. And then indeed you do see a wave of Mexicans trying to come to the United States for the simple reason that they find no jobs in Mexico.
Commenting on the context for the visit of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly to Mexico, Jorge Guajardo is Mexican ambassador to China from 2007 to 2013 and consul general to Mexico in Austin, Texas from 2005 to 2007. Ambassador, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Nice talking to you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at FloridaTheFutureIsHere.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A Holocaust denier is a political apostate in the 21st century. But a Holocaust forgetter? That's something else. Perhaps unique to President Trump, who neglected to mention the deaths of millions of Jews in the Holocaust in remarks some weeks ago. But yesterday, the president got the chance to make amends at a speech at the Smithsonian National Museum for African American History and Culture. The president also, for the first time, addressed the rise of anti-Jewish attacks and threats and the desecration of nearly 200 gravestones at a historic Jewish cemetery in Missouri this past weekend.
The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community centers are horrible and are painful and a very sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil.
Rabbi Jonah Pesner is the director of the Religious Action Center of Reformed Judaism in America, and he sees a rise of acts of hatred recently, and isn't completely confident, from what he's seen so far from the president, that Donald Trump can quell it.
Well, you know, it's very, very troubling, John, certainly for this act of desecration. It's disturbing. We have many, many of our family and friends who live in the St. Louis area whose families' graves were desecrated, so it's deeply personal. And there's a lot of fear because remember that our preschool children in Jewish community centers across the United States have been evacuated dozens of times over the last few weeks because of the threats.
Now, when you say evacuations, that's because of bomb threats?
That's right. There's been this ongoing wave of bomb threats, you know, throughout the United States where JCCs, which have preschools and day camps and activity centers, have been targeted, and it's incredibly frightening for young families and sending waves of fear through the Jewish community.
Well, listen to this listener of ours from far away from Washington, D.C., but it's a familiar anxiety. Just how would you counsel this woman? Listen.
Hello, this is Victoria Thor calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I work at a Jewish community center, and we have three schools located there. And last month, we received a bomb threat. And it was a very scary situation. We evacuated three schools to a safe location, babies, kids out of the pool, all wet in the winter. It was frightening. I'd like to know, Jews have stood with so many people in their civil rights movements and to get freedom and equality for everybody. Where is everybody when things happen to us?
I'm really moved by what Victoria said, and I hear her plea. In fact, I was so moved when I saw that there is an online drive organized by the Muslim American community to raise money to repair the desecrated cemetery. In fact, this Muslim group surpassed their fundraising goal within just hours of their online plea. So we're really seeing in an incredible way Christians, Muslims, Jews coming together against bigotry and hate in all forms. But Victoria's right to ask. We need to see from the top down. We need to hear the president loudly and persistently calling out antisemitism. We need to hear loudly from the attorney general and the FBI commitment to investigate all hate crimes. And we need local churches and local law enforcement to really stand with the Jewish community.
Another one of our listeners used the term the king of hate to describe our president and blamed two bomb threats at her Jewish community center for what's happened in Washington in recent weeks.
Look, we were glad that the president finally came out and spoke loudly and clearly. But as you know, actions speak much louder than words. So we need to see what the actions that will be directed by this president on his administration to have an ongoing commitment to investigate hate crimes. And frankly, words do matter. So we need to see persistent and consistent change in tone from this administration to emphasize the importance of beating back bigotry in all forms, and specifically to call out antisemitism wherever and whenever it festers.
Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., Rabbi Jonah Pesner is director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, John.
An important and global ripple from the Trump immigration policies in recent weeks is the perception that the U.S. favors some Muslims over others. Genevieve Abdo says for the point of view of the Middle East, Sunni Muslims from Saudi Arabia needn't worry, while Shiites from Iraq and Syria and Yemen are targeted and told to stay away. She says the message, unheard by most Americans, is very inflammatory in the Middle East.
I can't imagine that there won't be some sort of revenge that will be launched against the United States as a result of this.
Genevieve Abdo is the author of the new book, The New Sectarianism, The Arab Uprising and the Rebirth of the Shia-Sunni Divide. She says since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Sunni-Shia divide has been growing and increasingly becoming a conflict point.
Religion has become very important. How you practice Islam, who your religious reference points are, who your mentors are, that's very important, and that's why in the first page of the book I pose the question, which is, whose Islam is it? Is it the Islam of the Salafist, people who want to practice religion the way it was during the Prophet Muhammad? Is it the religion of the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt? Is it the religion of people who are more secularist-oriented? So that, to me, is the central question that is being contested.
How would you say the U.S. invasion in 2003 of Iraq disrupted a, for all of its negatives, what seemed to be a fairly stable Sunni-Shia coexistence?
We have to keep in mind that, of course, Saddam repressed the majority Shia population for so many decades, and that's why there was never an opportunity for this kind of religious expression that happened, of course, after he was out of power. So in a sense, these conflicts have always been there. The collapse and the weakening states, of course, have had a great deal to do with this, because now there isn't a centralized authority in many of these countries that's keeping the glue together, right? So that's why you have people who have taken it upon themselves to be religious authorities. And the way I call it in the book is the democratization of religion. So now there are many people who can interpret Islam, and there are many people who have authority because they've been granted authority by their societies, by their communities. And that's why the conflict is so deep, and that's why it's so violent, and unfortunately probably why it will continue.
Is there a obvious narrative that reaches some sort of conflagration here that you see in the next decade or so? Or is there a mechanism somewhere, Turkey, choose wherever, that might produce equilibrium in this conflict?
I think if we look at the way things stand today, I don't see any equilibrium. I mean, I think that in fact the opposite is happening, which is that people are becoming more polarized. And you see that in a country like Bahrain, which again, the uprising began as a Shia and Sunni uprising to create a more fair and just form of governance in Bahrain. But unfortunately, years later into the uprisings now, we are seeing that this polarization in society. So I think I always say that maybe the best case scenario we can hope for is a situation that exists now in Lebanon. Okay, so Lebanon went through a 15-year civil war a long time ago. Years, decades later, people always feared, oh, the war in Syria is coming to Lebanon. And that hasn't happened yet. I think that there's been sort of a social contract that's established in Lebanon. Okay, so you're Shia, you're Sunni, you're Christian, you're Maronite. We don't necessarily always see eye to eye, but we're going to try to prevent war. And however dysfunctional our state is, we're going to try to sustain the peace.
Genevieve Abdo is a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. Her book is The New Sectarianism, The Arab Uprising, and the Rebirth of the Shia-Sunni Divide. Genevieve, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
And now the tragedy of Libya. A country that once dreamed of liberation, now people inside pray just to survive, or if they decide to pay to get on an overcrowded boat, they pray that their bodies will be found if something terrible happens on the dangerous sea route from Libya to Italy. 74 bodies washed up on the shores of Libya Monday morning, migrants attempting to flee to Italy across the Mediterranean. Mary Fitzgerald is a journalist specializing in Libya, a contributing author to The Libyan Revolution and its aftermath. Mary, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John.
What is it about the climate and the seasonal changes that take place around this time of year that make this such a dangerous crossing?
Well, usually the winter months are a time when the number of migrants trying to make that perilous journey from Libya to Europe reduces. But what we've seen over the last year or so is that more and more migrants are choosing to make the journey during those winter months, despite the fact that weather and sea conditions are not conducive. And of course, that leads then to incidents like we saw this week, where basically over 74 people were killed when the very flimsy inflatable raft that they were traveling on seems to have capsized.
What is it about the interior sort of political situation in Libya that creates this level of desperation?
Well, it's important to remember that during the Gaddafi era, Libya was also a very popular transit point for migrants trying to get from countries in sub-Saharan Africa to Europe. And indeed, Gaddafi used this to his advantage. He at times threatened European countries that he would open and close the flow of migration like a tap in order to gain political leverage in Brussels and other European capitals. Since his fall in the uprising of 2011, we've seen a number of different dynamics change in that the existing people smuggling networks that had been operating during the Gaddafi era, they expanded, new networks emerged. And in many cases, these people smuggling networks became entwined with the militias that had sprung up during and after the uprising against Gaddafi. So it's a very dense kind of complex web now that underpins what has essentially become an industry in Libya, and particularly in southern Libya, near Libya's southern border, but also in the communities along Libya's western coast. So basically, you have a situation where this was already happening prior to 2011. Also, you have a situation where migrants that in years previously would have come to Libya with the idea of settling in Libya for a number of years, working in Libya, and then making money to try and get to Europe. Now they don't want to stay in Libya because of the situation in Libya, the insecurity and the risk they run of being detained and mistreated.
It sounds like what you're describing cynically, this industry based on people smuggling, is a consequence of Libya having become three separate rogue states broken off from what was once this dictatorship. Is that where we are now?
Well, right now in Libya, you have three entities claiming to be the government. You have one UN-backed, internationally recognized government, which calls itself a unity government, but really is a unity government just in name, just on paper. That sits in Tripoli. It is challenged by a rival government in eastern Libya and is challenged by another entity in Tripoli, the capital, that also claims to be a government. So With all those rivalries and those claims to legitimacy, you essentially have a worsening political vacuum, which is underpinned by a wider security vacuum. This situation inside Libya is the reason why so many have been expressing concern and expressing serious misgivings over the migration deal that was signed this month between Libya and Italy. It's a bilateral migration agreement. It has been presented as an EU deal on migration. But that agreement was basically with that UN-backed backed government in Tripoli. The reason people are raising a lot of questions about this deal, one of the reasons rather, is the question of what authority that UN-backed government has in Tripoli. It has struggled to impose its authority in the capital, let alone other parts of the country. So there are real questions about the capacity for this UN-backed government to implement this deal in any meaningful way.
Best case scenario, if you were a family embarking on a journey from Libya today to somewhere in Europe, what could you hope for? How long would you be at sea? And what kinds of deprivation would you suffer?
It really depends, because right now you have a situation where Italy has been training the Libyan Coast Guard. That's kind of part of Italy's attempts to try and stem the flow of migrants towards Europe, because most of them end up in Italy. You also have search and rescue missions carried out by European countries. Also, aid organizations have been involved in some of these rescue attempts. So basically, if you take a boat from one of the hubs in Western Libya, your journey could be cut short by the Coast Guard. It could be cut short by the search and rescue teams. Your boat could capsize or get into trouble in the middle of the Mediterranean. The figures so far from the International Organization for Migration indicate that almost 9,500 migrants have arrived in Europe from Libya by sea this year, while 270 were reported dead or missing.
Finally, Mary Fitzgerald, what would a family typically pay for the journey, for the crossing, to ride on one of these boats that's basically a death sentence?
An individual will have to pay several thousand dollars at different different sums at different points of his or her journey. So most of the migrants are basically doing the journey by stages. They will cross over the border as Libya's southern borders, and then they will be passed from smuggler to smuggler until they arrive in those hubs. So thousands of dollars will have changed hands per individual by the time they get on those rickety boats.
Mary Fitzgerald is a contributing author to the book The Libyan Revolution and Its Aftermath. She joins me from Marseille, which is on the frontier there, looking at the Mediterranean. She's a journalist specializing in Libya. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website building platform that helps businesses, entrepreneurs, and individuals to create websites, portfolios, online stores, and more. Learn more at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move. By LegalZoom, helping Americans with legal needs for over 15 years, including business formation and estate plans through a network of independent attorneys licensed in 48 states. More information at LegalZoom.com.
The deadly Syrian civil war and the global refugee crisis have found their way into some films nominated for Oscars this year in the Best Documentary and Best Documentary Short categories. We thought we would reprise moments from those conversations with remarkable filmmakers taking incredible risks to tell, in some cases, the saddest of stories. Italian director Gianfranco Rosi's film Fire at Sea tells the story of the migrants' crisis largely from the perspective of a 10-year-old boy who lives on the island of Lampedusa, which lies in the crosshairs of a migrant route halfway between Tunis and Tripoli in the Mediterranean Sea.
How many people? How many people?
250.
Your position.
There is in danger. Please, you beg, you please, as ever.
Your position.
In the name of God.
Your position.
Yeah, our position.
Your position.
We are in the Mediterranean Sea. We are in the Mediterranean Sea. Please.
Your
please, we beg you.
Your position. My friend. Hello. Hello.
What were you feeling?
Was what I feel exactly now, the sense of impotence and a sense of really shivering and cold and impotence mostly, because these voices, this cry for help, they happen every day constantly. There are these boats, they live from Libya in very, very desperate condition. These boats are not able to cross the sea, and most of that time they sink after 2-3 hours of navigation. So more than 20,000 people die in the last 15 years tried to cross Libya to arrive to Lampedusa to reach freedom. And this is one of the biggest tragedy Europe is facing. And when I hear this sound, you know, there is so much desperation in those voices. And this, unfortunately, was these people, they were never found.
They were never found.
I was witnessing this for 40 days, every day. One day we did more than 2,000 rescue in one single day from the military boat. 2,000 people were brought alive in the things. And then one day, unfortunately, I encountered death, and death came to me. I didn't want to film death. I always avoided to film death in my film because I know how big responsibility is to put your camera on someone that is a dead body. And that day I met death, and I met, unfortunately, 50 people that died under the boat. And I went down there to film that scene. And it was very difficult. I had the support of the commander of the Navy that he told me it's your responsibility to film that. This is like being in front of a chamber gas and not filming because it's too harsh. You have to show this to the world. And I forced myself to go down there and I filmed that 30 seconds that appear in the film. And so then the whole film was somehow to build in order to show this tragedy, and not only to arrive there and show the death, but also to be able to go out of that and give somehow dignity also to the people that I was filming in Lampedusa. So it was a choral journey somehow to show the tragedy of death in my film.
My conversation with director Gianfranco Rosi took place back in October.
There isn't any worse feeling than being a refugee.
Dafti Matsiaraki's 4.1 Miles was nominated for an Oscar for Documentary Short Subject. Aboard a Greek Coast Guard ship, the filmmaker captured multiple rescues by one captain, Kyriakos Papadopoulos, in a single day, all within the 4.1-mile stretch between the Turkish coast and the Greek island of Lesbos.
I found out that this Coast Guard captain and all the four Coast Guard captains that are on the island have no training to respond to this kind of emergency. And suddenly they found themselves caught in this huge crisis, in the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. They were completely unprepared, not trained, without any equipment. My main character, Kyriakos Papadopoulos, has no CPR training. His boat is very small and doesn't have the necessary equipment to respond to something like that. They don't even have thermal cameras. But in this vast emergency, he has no other option but to respond.
When did you feel that you were right up into the face of the crisis?
Well, the point where I felt I was really in the middle of this was when I went on the Coast Guard boat. I really didn't know what to expect. Kyriakos got a call that there was an incident. One of the small dinghy boats, the motor had stopped in the middle of the sea, like many of them do all the time. So we had to go and find this dinghy boat. And on the way there, it was so stressful. And you can see it in the film. They don't even know where they're going. They're looking in the sea. And then suddenly, we see a boat, a tiny little inflatable boat, where it's meant to hold 5-6 people, packed with 80 people, 100 people, something like that, packed with small kids and mothers, and everyone being so scared. And whilst the crew was trying to get these people up, a mother with two small boys fell in the water. Waves were big. It was the middle of the winter. The water is very cold. And these people have never seen the sea before. They don't know how to swim, most likely. And I saw the fear in their eyes. I've never seen people so scared in my life. And it felt like they were traumatized, deeply traumatized, because these people were coming from war. I've never felt so close to war, and I've never seen kids so scared in my life. That made me feel so helpless and so small. And when I realized that this was not just one boat, but this was happening every minute, it was people coming in masses.
scared people coming, and they were risking everything. And these people, after talking to so many of them, they felt that they were going to die one way or another. So it was just, for me, unreal to see people in that stage, in the waters of my peaceful country.
What did this teach you about what it must be like to face war in your own home?
It's history repeated in a lot of ways. There isn't any worse feeling than being a refugee, than having to flee your home, having to leave everything behind, and come with nothing to a different country where you don't have anything, and people often treat you as second-class or third-class citizen. So I would say that we really need to rethink the choices that we make and how we act and how we treat our fellow human beings, because maybe it wouldn't happen to us in the same way. I don't think that people in Syria thought that it would happen to them either.
That's journalist and documentary filmmaker Daphne Matsiraki. We spoke to her in December, and you can find those full interviews on our website at thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow, we'll bring you a few minutes of my conversation with director Kahani Cooperman on her incredible documentary, Joe's Violin, also up for an Oscar. Good luck to all of our contenders. And that's our show for today. And as this is the actual birthday of George Washington, you can read some of my thoughts in a blog post about how this year's President's Day may have more meaning as we suddenly contemplate what a president is in these turbulent times. As always, just go to thetakeaway.org, and we always want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.